In this HRA podcast, we take a look at the anti-vivisection movement and some of the key organisations that paved the way for HRA. The meaning of the word vivisection may not be commonly known by the general public. However, most of you listening will likely know that vivisection is the practice of performing operations on live animals for the purpose of experimentation or scientific research. Where and when did vivisection start? So some of the earliest recordings of vivisection appear in the 2nd century when Claudius Galen, a physician, writer, and philosopher during the Roman Empire, began experimenting on animals in the name of medical science. The experiments he conducted are too horrifying to repeat. Suffice to say that from then on, medical advancement was to head down the wrong path for centuries. In the 17th century, the philosopher René Descartes advocated for the vivisection of animals and practiced it himself. He argued that this is ethical because animals are biological machines and therefore suffer no pain, even if they seem to scream in agony. But it was in the mid-19th century when the French physiologist Claude Bernard, known as the founder of the modern vivisection method, furthered the misnomer that animal experimentation would enhance knowledge and capacity to cure human illnesses. Here we have a quote from Bernard. "The physiologist is not an ordinary man. He does not hear the cries of animals. He does not see their flowing blood. He sees nothing but his idea, and is aware of nothing but an organism that conceals from him the problem he is seeking to solve." Bernard convinced the scientific community that if a disease could not be replicated in animals, it could not exist. It soon became understood among scientists that animal experimentation could provide both money and reputation. Bernard didn't consider his work immoral, and even used his family pet, a dog. So callous was his work that his own wife, Marie-Francoise Bernard, founded one of the world's first anti-vivisection movements. In his posthumous published work, he advised vivisectors to practice their discipline secretly, and this is predominantly where it has stayed, secret and underground. Soon after the turn of the century, vivisection became known as biomedical research and became hidden from society's view. There's artwork from the early 19th century by Émile-Édouard Mouchy depicting the vivisection of a dog. You can see that there was an element of theatre in the way vivisection was conducted and perceived during those times. The anti-vivisection movement in the period 1860 to 1910 was one of the strongest debates of the time. We would like to share the stories of four influential anti-vivisectionist campaigners who were also prominent feminists and socialists at the time. First, we have Anna Kingsford. In order to speak from a position of authority on anti-vivisection, Anna Kingsford enrolled in a degree in medicine. She was often the only female student in her class, and yet despite this, she still refused to allow any animals to be vivisected in any classes she attended. After passing her first medical exam in London in 1872, she chose to continue her education in Paris, the epicentre of intellectual activity and science. In 1880, she graduated at the age of 33 and was the first English woman to receive a degree in medicine. After this, she devoted the rest of her life to writing and speaking on behalf of animals. She died at the age of 41 in 1888. It was 4 years after her death in 1892 that the British Medical Association finally accepted female doctors. Next, we have Frances Power Cobb. Not only an anti-vivisectionist, Cobb was also a social reformer, and her essay, Wife Torture in England, directly influenced the UK Parliament in passing the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1878 for the benefit of working-class women who lived in abusive marriages. In 1875, she founded the National Anti-Vivisection Society, and not long after, the BUAV, British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection, in 1898, which is now known as Cruelty Free International. Cobb was instrumental in drafting the Cruelty to Animals Act, 1876. She was also a very active participant in the women's suffrage movement, and in 1867, Cobb became a member of the Executive Council of the London National Society for Women's Suffrage. In 1884, she retired to Wales with her partner, Mary Lloyd, and at the age of 82, she died of heart failure at her home on the 5th of April 1904, and was buried alongside Mary Lloyd, who had died in 1896. But there are two women of the anti-vivisection movement that we would like to talk about in more detail, and they are Louise Lind Arf Hagby, who was a Swedish-British feminist and animal rights activist, and Lisha Katarina Chartau, a Swedish activist. Both these women made very significant contributions to the anti-vivisection movement. But before hearing their story, let's first set the scene of England at this time during the late 1800s to mid-1900s. So this was a time when women did not have the right to vote, were not allowed to study to become lawyers, and were not permitted to be doctors until 1892. It was a time when prominent medical scientists insisted that a woman who educated herself took the risk of damaging her uterus and therefore would not be able to have children. It was a time when women of the social class to which Hagby and Chartau belonged were expected to wait at home for their husbands, whiling away time. However, not these two activists. Hagby was a formidable organiser and debater. The women had known each other since childhood. In 1900, they visited the Pasteur Institute in Paris. Here, they were shocked to witness rooms of caged, diseased animals. On their return home from Paris, they founded the Anti-Vivisection Society of Sweden. Their activism led to what became known as the Brown Dog Affair, 1903 to 1910. In 1902, in order to gain medical training to help their campaigning, both Hagby and Chartau enrolled in the London School of Medicine for Women, a vivisection-free college that had visiting rights with other colleges. They attended hundreds of lectures and demonstrations at both King's and University College, including experiments on live animals. But in 1903, Hagby and Chartau attended a lecture being conducted by Ernest Starling and William Bayliss. It was here they witnessed the vivisection of an unanaesthetized dog in front of some 60 medical students. In this time, dogs were not bred specifically for experiments, but were strays plucked off the streets. The two women produced a record of what they had witnessed and published it as The Shambles of Science, Extracts from the Diary of Two Students of Physiology, 1903. It included a chapter entitled Fun, referring to the laughter they said they heard in the lecture room during the procedure. The women's account stated, "A large dog, stretched on its back on an operation board, is carried into the lecture room by a demonstrator and a laboratory attendant. Its legs are fixed to the board, its head is firmly held in the usual manner and is tightly muzzled. There is a large incision in the side of the neck, exposing the gland. The animal exhibits all signs of intense suffering. In his struggles, he again and again lifts his body from the board and makes powerful attempts to get free." An excerpt from the diary. Stephen Coldridge, a lawyer and general secretary of the National Anti-Vivisection Society, was horrified by the account and made a public accusation that Bayliss had broken the law and had tortured the dog. But with his professional reputation at stake, Bayliss sued Coleridge for defamation. The jury found Coleridge guilty of defamation, and the chapter Fun, describing the laughter, was deleted from later editions. Animal rights campaigners were outraged by the trial's result and raised money to have a bronze statue of the dog erected in Battersea, London, in 1906. Below the statue was the inscription, "In memory of the brown terrier dog done to death in the laboratories of University College in February 1903, after having endured vivisection extending over more than 2 months and having been handed over from one vivisector to another till death came to his release. Men and women of England, how long shall these things be?" Medical students were angered by its provocative words, leading to frequent vandalism and 24-hour police guard. On 10th December 1907, fury was transformed into action. 1,000 medical students marched through central London, waving effigies of the brown dog, clashing with suffragettes, trade unionists, and 400 police officers in one of the series of battles known as the Brown Dog Riots. Hugby always claimed that the differences in physiology between the species and their different reactions to drugs means the results are not transferable to humans. She also argued that the method used to cause disease and unnatural conditions signifies that results will be unreliable. In March 1910, due to the controversy, the brown dog statue was removed by the Battersea Council, despite a 20,000-strong petition in support of it. In December 1985, a new brown dog memorial was erected by one Geraldine James, a Battersea resident and anti-vivisectionist, funded by the BUAV and the NAVS. This time, there was no foundation or drinking trough, and the brown dog is a terrier based on the sculptor Nicola Hicks's dog. It stands today in Battersea Park. There is an Australian link to the brown dog affair. In 1985, a book called The Old Brown Dog, Women, Workers and Vivisection in Edwardian England, was written by Australian academic Coral Lansbury, who also happens to be the mother of former PM Malcolm Turnbull. This book made a strong link between socialism, feminism, and vivisection. So whatever happened to Louise Lind Arve Haugby? Arve Haugby co-founded the Animal Defence and Anti-Vivisection Society and the journal The Anti-Vivisection Review with Nina Douglas, Duchess of Hamilton. The Duchess herself, a staunch anti-vivisectionist, set up Fern Animal Sanctuary in 1939, leaving it to the Society on her death in 1951. From 1954, Haugby ran the 237-acre sanctuary. Active throughout her long life, she addressed an international conference of anti-vivisection societies in London only a few weeks before her death at the age of 95 in 1963. Unfortunately, of Lisa Chartow, we know nothing. So, although Claude Bernard advised vivisectors to practice their discipline secretly, and despite vivisection becoming known as biomedical research and going underground and predominantly staying there, the anti-vivisection movement still continued to grow and spread around the world. It soon made its way to Australia, with various anti-vivisection groups forming around the country. The Melbourne branch of the BUAV, now known as Cruelty Free International, was formed on November 17, 1922. Helena McDougall became the first vice president of Melbourne BUAV. There are archival images from the State Library of Victoria which documented some of the outreach activities of these early anti-vivisection organisations in Melbourne. There is one photograph of a Melbourne train carriage in the mid-1900s with a BUAV anti-vivisection campaign advertisement displayed inside the carriage with the heading, "No cruelty is useful." There are also photographs available of BUAV outreach stands in Melbourne and in areas such as Collingwood in the 1920s. Although there were a number of anti-vivisection organisations in Australia, there was not one in New South Wales. In October 1979, Elizabeth Alston formed the Australian Association for Humane Research, now known as Humane Research Australia. Prior to that, she had worked for the World League for the Protection of Animals and was the Australian representative for the British organisation FRAME, Fund for the Replacement of Animals in Medical Experiments, and all her work was voluntary. She worked in the anti-vivisection movement for over 40 years and is now in her 90s. Up until the 1990s, there were a number of anti-vivisection organisations, including Australian Association Against Painful Experiments on Animals and the Anti-Vivisection Union of South Australia and Western Australia. In 2005, HRA was handed to a management committee, these days comprised of biomedical researchers themselves, who now recognise the futility of vivisection. The organisation was relocated to Melbourne, with the late Helen Marsden appointed as CEO. We dedicate this podcast in memory of Helen Marsden, who was a passionate anti-vivisection activist and much loved and respected member of the community. Today, HRA Australia is Australia's leading anti-vivisection non-for-profit organisation of its kind in Australia.